John Peterson wrote a song in 1949 that I remember singing as a kid, or kind of being one of those take me back to my youth type of days. I think it was recorded in a chorus book or a record, actually I think is where I heard it, on a Singing with Marcy. You guys remember Singing with Marcy? This little puppet girl that would sing like this and have a... You don't remember that either. Oh, I think we had two or three records of different records with Singing with Marcy that I would listen to as a children. But what the song that I was remembering this last week goes, "Why worry when you can pray? Trust Jesus, he'll lead the way. Don't be a doubting Thomas, rest fully in his promise. Why worry, 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 worry when you can pray?" Does anyone remember that song? I mean, does that sound familiar? Mom and Dad, we sang it a lot growing up in church, I think, in the churches that I grew up in. None of you have sung? No? "Why worry when you can pray? Trust Jesus, he'll lead the way. Don't be a doubting Thomas, rest fully in his promise. Why worry, worry, worry when you can pray?" Type of, yeah, that's, anyways. Yes, 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 no applause needed. I'm surprised, that, like I said, I thought that would be a common song that you guys would remember because it's a short little chorus. I think it even had some verses to it, I don't know. I couldn't find the actual words. I kind of found some videos online and whatnot, and I found, of course, the cover of Singing with Marcy, which, again, I thought was, I guess that was just me, I guess, I grew up with that. But that came to mind this last week as I was looking at Psalm chapter 37, because we've been going through a series here on our morning worships, Psalms We Love, and I've been asking you guys, hey, what psalms do you love? Give them to me, and I will preach on the psalm, and we'll just kind of one of those type of things where you pick what you want me to preach upon. And this week is Psalm 37, and this I think my wife picked. I think is it 51. So someone else picked 37. Is anyone pick a 37 out there today? Ooh, okay. Maybe they're not here. I'm pretty sure someone asked me to preach on this because I normally probably wouldn't preach on it because this wasn't really my favorite psalm. But anyways, this is one of the psalms I believe was requested. And so we're going to teach about the Psalm chapter 37, I should say. And as I looked over this psalm, there are several key phrases that we'll see in this psalm that are repeated over and over again. The first one is, do not fret. Do not fret, as we'll see. And the other is inherit the land. And so putting those two phrases together, along with my childhood memory, I came up with the title for this morning's message, Why Worry When You Have Land? Okay? Fretting and worrying and when you have land, I guess. So that's why I came up with the sermon title this morning. Again, sounds like none of you heard the song, so you don't know what I'm talking about, but that's okay. So we're going to read through Psalm 37 this morning and keep these two phrases in mind, do not fret or do not worry and inherit the land, and see how many times David uses these in the psalm. And normally when I preach, I usually put the psalm up on the screen so you can read it by yourself, but this is a long psalm. It would take me like 30 or, well, maybe 10 slides probably to put it all up there, and that'd get me to press the button so many times up here. I didn't even put it in my notes this morning, so I'm going to have to read it actually from my Bible. Sometimes I put it in my notes, and so I can read it from my notes or read it from the screen here. But I didn't do that this morning because it's such a long psalm. So if you have your Bibles or pew Bibles in front of you this morning, it's in your pew Bibles on page 641. And so it's nice to have it open and you can read through it because I'm going to be skipping around in this psalm. It's not going to be one of those things where I do it section by section like I usually have done. But it's going to be kind of all over the place. So if you have your Bibles or if you have an app on your phone, you can open your app on your phone and read along with me. So Psalm 37, and you can read along in the pew Bible in front of you this morning. It says, "Do not fret because of evil men or be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in a land and enjoy safe pasture. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your ways to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteousness shine like the dawn, and justice of your cause like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when evil men succeed their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret. It only leads to evil. For evil men will be cut off, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. In a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. But the meek will inherit the land. They will enjoy peace. The wicked plot against the righteous and gnash their teeth at them. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he knows their day is coming. The wicked draw the sword and bend the bow to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose ways are upright. But their swords will pierce their own hearts. Their bows will be broken. Better the little that the righteous have than the wealth of many wicked. For the power of the wicked will be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. The days of the blameless are known to the Lord, and their inheritance will endure forever. In the times of disaster, they will not wither. In the days of famine, they will enjoy plenty. But the wicked will perish. The Lord's enemies will be like the beauty of the fields, that they vanish like smoke. The wicked borrow and do not repay, but the righteous gives generously. Those who the Lord blesses will inherit the land, but those he curses will be cut off. If the Lord delights in a man's way, he makes his steps firm. Though he stumbles, he will not fall, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. I was young, and now I am old, yet I have never seen the righteous forsaken or their children begging for bread. They are always generous and lend freely. Their children will be blessed. Turn from evil and do good. Then you will dwell in the land forever. For the Lord loves the just and will not forsake his faithful ones. They will be protected forever. But the offspring of the wicked will be cut off. The righteous will inherit the land and dwell in it forever. The wisdom of the righteous man utters wisdom, but his tongue speaks what is just. The law of the Lord, the law of his God is in his heart. His feet do not slip. The wicked lie in wait for the righteous, seeking their very lives, but the Lord will not leave them in their power or let them be condemned when brought to trial. Wait for the Lord and keep his ways. He will exalt you to inherit the land where the wicked are cut off when you see it. When you have seen the wicked and ruthless men flourishing like green trees in its native soil, but soon he passes away and was no more. Though I looked for him, he could not be found. Consider the blameless. Observe the upright. There is a future for a man of peace. But all sinners will be destroyed. The future of the wicked will be cut off. The salvation of the righteous comes from the Lord. He is their stronghold in time of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him. Now, there's a lot in this passage. There's a lot here, and it's kind of almost like a mismatch organization type of thing. In fact, there wasn't very much organization in some of the commentaries I saw this last week. But I think the main topic of these verses is the promise that God will reward the righteous with good things as they follow God, and the wicked will not, because God promises rewards to those who seek him. And so let's take a look at this psalm this morning and see some different things in here that I observed. And I wish I had, a nice outline that had kind of an organization to it, but again, it kind of was not. But first of all, this psalm is an alphabet psalm, or the technical word is acrostic. Acrostic song. If you can't see this in the English versions, but it's clearly seen in the Hebrew. Every other verse is the next letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It starts with Aleph, the A in Hebrew, and then a couple verses later, it starts with Bet, which is the B in Hebrew language, and Gamel and Dil and all those letters. It's every other couple verses, with a few exceptions here and there. It's an alphabet. It just follows. It's kind of like the ABCs. If we would write these verses out, we would start off with, I don't know how to do not fret. I was going to think about the acrostic, and I even was going to write it out. But it starts with the ABCs of the Hebrew language. So this is the purpose of this was kind of to memorize this psalm, and it's a long psalm to memorize, but if you have kind of a think, oh yes, I can think of A. Okay, what does it go with A? Yes, means do not fret in the Hebrew language, you know. And so you can think of that and memorize the psalm. Because it's the psalm is kind of thrown together. Because it's a very practical psalm. In fact, it almost sounds like a Proverbs. If I didn't tell you where I found this at, you would think I was reading from the book of Proverbs this morning, because it has all kinds of these, the righteous do this and the wicked do this, and the kind of comparison there that we see also in the book of Proverbs. He gives us short commands or sayings about how the righteous should live in comparison with the unrighteous or the wicked. And so there's this alphabet part of this psalm that kind of helps the people memorize this psalm even better. And we'll get to here in a few weeks, we'll get to 119th Psalm. The 119th Psalm is also an alphabet psalm that has this acrostic, and every section of verses, the first eight verses, start with the letter A, and I'll show you that here in a few weeks when we get to Psalm 119. But it starts with a different letter of the alphabet to kind of help you memorize and get to know what's going on. So this, first of all, is an acrostic alphabet. But second of all, I've seen here there's several phrases that are repeated. Several things that are repeated, as I was reading through this chapter multiple times this last week, I kept thinking, okay, I think I've heard that before as I read that. Did I just read that last time, or did I read it just now? And so I kept noticing words and phrases that kept repeating themselves. And one of them, the first of them, is do not fret. It's repeated three times in this chapter, verses 1, 7, and 8. But I also found it very interesting that as I was looking at do not fret this last week, that actually the first verse there in Psalm 37 is actually repeated in the Proverbs. If you look at Proverbs 24:19, it says, do not fret because of evil men or be envious of the wicked. And it's the exact same phrase, do not fret because of evil men or be envious of the ones who do wrong. The very same thing except for the last word, which is wicked in the Proverbs and do wrong in the Psalms. And as I look at that fret and do not fret, I thought, do not worry. And I thought, let me look up this word again, fret. And it's only used four times in the Bible, the word fret. In many of our translations, it's used only four times. It's used three times here in this psalm, and it's used in that proverb I've just read from Proverbs 14:19. So I mentioned those four times that this word fret is repeated, both in our NIV, the King James versions, the New English translation, and the New NRSV. All use these, it's only used fret. So if you look up in your concordance, fret is only used these four times. I thought that was kind of strange why fret is not used, because I thought, oh, worry and fret, and that's what I thought, because as I, again, did more research on this word fret, where it came from, we usually define it as being constantly or visibly worried or anxious. Is that what you think of when you think of the word fret? That's why I titled the message, Don't Worry, or Why Worry? But that's not what I found out when I looked behind this word. When I looked at the Hebrew word behind it, it's not really an unusual word like fret. Fret's an unusual word in our English. But in the Hebrew version, fret, or the word kara, is used 90 times in the Old Testament. So why is it only translated fret four of those times? And so I, again, did more research, and it's not normally translated fret. It's translated anger. Kind of the burning anger, you know, the kind of the deep-seated anger that burns inside you. It's translated that. In fact, the word is used in Exodus 31 when God showed the Israelites anger because Moses had come down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments. He had the tablets with him, and they came down, and what did Moses see when he came down the first time? He saw the golden calf. The Israelites, while he was up in the mountain, built this golden calf and were worshiping it, and Moses got so furious, he burst the tablets down and was so angry, and God, it says God was angry there and just kind of blew up because they were worshiping this golden calf. The word is also used back in Joshua, when Achan took the forbidden things from the city of Jericho. Jericho was supposed to be destroyed totally. And Achan took some certain things, and it says God burned with anger at Achan, and it caused them to be defeated the next time they were in battle. This word is also used, I found very interesting, when God burned with anger against Uzziah. Uzziah was walking alongside of the Ark of the Covenant. David was taking the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem, and he was built a cart with some oxen that were taking the cart up there. And Uzziah, the Ark started to tip, and Uzziah touched his hands out there to steady the Ark, and God killed him right away in anger, it says there, because he had touched the Ark of the Covenant. It wasn't being moved like he wanted it to. That's in 1 Chronicles 13. So this word fret here has at its meaning, at its basis, in the Hebrew, of an anger that burns inside of you, eating you from the inside out. And so again, I thought, okay, what does that have to do with worry? I mean, fret means worry, doesn't it? Well, no, actually. Even though you translate it fret, I did some more digging. Originally, fret did not mean worry. Okay, it was actually used in one of our first English translations of the Bible. It's called the Geneva Bible. It's actually back in 1560 was printed out. 1560, that was before the King James Version came out. King James Version came out in 1611. But before that, there was another English version. It's called the Geneva Bible. And the translator of that used the word frete, which is the English word that they used then. But again, he only used it those four times. I don't know why he didn't translate it more accurately. But he used it, so that's where the word fret gets into our English versions today. But back in the Old English, they did not use fret for worry in that day. Instead, the word back then meant something to be devoured, something gnawing into or eating something up. It has this idea of chewing or biting, gnawing away. And so as I thought about that, I thought that's kind of the perfect image of anger in our lives, isn't it? How kind of anger inside of us gnaws at us. It kind of nips at us. It kind of burns us from the inside out. Eats us out. Eats us up from the inside out. Destroying you because of this anger. And so when we're told not to fret, it's meaning not to be angry, not to burn with anger against these evil doers when we see them succeed. Because throughout this chapter, we will see that the wicked at times appear very solid. Appear very strong. Verse 14 tells us that they are armed with swords and bows. Verse 35 even compares them to a flourishing and thriving tree planted in its native soil. They look strong and vibrant in verse 2. They're called successful in verse 7. And so these wicked appear strong. And so the whole complaint is, God, why are these wicked people flourishing, being strong, being so upset at us? And so he says, you don't need to fret about that, David says, when evil men are envious of those who do wrong, because they'll pass away. Throughout, we'll see that success is only temporary. We'll see that they're going to be cut off, which is another repeated phrase, repeated five times in this passage of Scripture. They'll be cut off. Cut off has many implications to inheriting the land, which we'll see later on. But this is something that David is familiar with, because in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 4, God promises David that his descendants will be with, in that his descendants, where did I put it? I lost my place here. That his descendants will not be cut off. That his descendants will be on the throne forever. It says, I'm not going to cut you off, David. I cut off Saul because of his sin, but because of your righteousness, because of what you've done, because of the heart that you have for me, your descendants will never be cut off. And not only will the wicked be cut off, but in a similar way, it says that their success, their being green, will eventually wither away. Verse 2, it'll vanish like smoke. Verse 20, it'll say it won't be found anymore. Verse 36, these wicked who appear strong, who appear to be outside of God's justice and are flourishing, will eventually face the judgment of God. That's what the psalm is teaching, that the righteous are not to get angry when they see the temporary success of the wicked, because God is in control, and he'll make sure that justice will take place. And so because of that, the righteous can trust God. We see that repeated time and time again. We see trust in verses 3 and verse 5. We see the word wait, which implies the word trust, in verses 7 and 34. We see hope in verse in verse 9. This whole idea of trusting in God, and we talked about that last week when we talked about Psalm 27, how God can be trusted, how we can be confident in God. And that whole idea that we talked about last week about confidence in God. And if you need to, you can hear online if you want to. But that confidence, that trust in God that we have to keep these taking place, that's all repeated many times in here. But there's also not just repeated phrases, but there's also contrasting characters in this passage of Scripture as well. There's a contrast between the wicked and the righteous. The wicked are mentioned 14 times in this chapter, as well as similar phrases like those who do wrong or evil men or ruthless or sinners. Repeated 14 plus times. And despite appearing strong, like I said, successful, they are temporary and will perish. I like how verse 14 and 15 describe them. It says, the wicked draw their sword and bend the bow to break down the poor and the needy, to slay those who are upright. But despite being strong, it says, their swords will pierce their own hearts and their bows will be broken. You know, they appear strong, they appear with these swords, but the swords, they're going to stab themselves with it. Just like in those movies, these action-packed movies that you've seen on TV or in the movies, where the good guy comes and the bad guys have a gun ready to point at him, and the good guy comes and snatches up the gun and kind of twists him around and kind of holds him in front of him while he shoots the other bad guys, and then eventually shoots the one that he's holding hostage, or they take the gun and they use the gun against the person that's wielding it. That's just like what David is saying here. These swords, these bows are going to be used against these wicked people. It's kind of like the story in Esther, in the book of Esther in the Bible, where Haman builds this gallows to hang Mordecai. He builds these huge, tall gallows. And what happens in the end? Haman actually gets hung on his own gallows. That's the picture we have here, that these righteous people appear strong, appear to be in control, and yet their own weapons are going to be used against them. These wicked people plot against the righteous. They gnash their teeth at them, as it says in verse 12. These wicked people lie in wait for the righteous, trying to gain power over them. They're looking after their own selves and what they can gain, and not trusting in God. By implication, they're trusting in their own abilities to make it on their own. But as I pointed out already, they'll be cut off when God judges them. They'll have no rights or future blessings. Their protections, their swords and their bows will be used against them. And this is in contrast to the righteous. The righteous are mentioned many times in the Scripture as well. The righteous, 9 times by righteous, but also as well those who hope, the meek, the upright, the blameless, the faithful ones. All these are the righteous people. Have many different characteristics that are different from the wicked. Different characteristics that I've already mentioned here in this passage already. In fact, there are too many to really list. I was going to list all the benefits of being righteous, but again, that'd take up a big whole couple screens. But they'll be in plenty. One of them was in plenty. In times of disaster, it says, they will not wither. In the days of famine, they will enjoy plenty, verse 19. I like how the Berkeley translation translates this verse. It says, even in the days of famine, they'll be satisfied. You know, these righteous people are going to be satisfied. We're going to be satisfied even in the days of famine. And that might not necessarily be food, but it goes along with what David says there in verse 25, his testimony about when he's in an old age. He's never have seen the righteous forsaken, or their children begging for bread. I think this is kind of what Jesus is talking about in the New Testament when God talks about the sparrows and how God loves the sparrows so much and cares for them and knows when one of them falls that he cares for us as well. Again, reminds me of the chorus, the song, His Eyes on a Sparrow. And the first line of that is, why do I need to worry? It sounds like the same line of this psalm. Why do I need to worry? Why do I need to fret? God's in control. God's going to help me out. We're going to be protected by God. Verse 28 says, for the Lord loves the just and will not forsake his faithful ones. They'll be protected forever. See, all these are wonderful promises that God gives to the righteous, all these rewards that we've seen. And of course, the biggest reward that this psalm points out is, why worry when you have land, inheriting the land? This last reward about inheriting land is mentioned 5 times in this psalm. And that's not including the other ideas that go along with this inheriting of the land. Because inheriting the land means inheriting the land, first of all, and then we have, second of all, dwelling in the land, mentioned 3 times, and also inheritance is mentioned in verse 18. So what does it mean to inherit the land? Why worry when you have this land? Well, the first possibility is that land means actually the land of Israel. You see, God had promised Abraham clear back in Abraham's day that I'm going to give you a land where you can dwell, this promised land. But Abraham never sees this promised land. He's a foreigner. He's I'm trying to think of the word, and I just lost it. He travels around. He's a traveler. He never does own a piece of land other than a small piece of land that he bought for his wife's gravestone. He wanders. He's a wanderer. They wander down to Egypt, and Moses brings them out of Egypt with this promised land. Joshua brought them into the promised land and began the conquest, and the judges and under King Saul, the pagan inhabitants were slowly defeated in the land. But they had not yet controlled it all. And then David comes along and conquers and expands it some more. But the extent of the God's promise to Moses and to Joshua was that they would be all of Israel from this point to the Euphrates River, and that really didn't take place until after David died and Solomon came. After this psalm was written, was when the fullness of God's promise. So there's a possibility that David is referring to inheriting the entire land that God promised them. And they take it as an encouragement to the readers in David's day that God will remain faithful to the promise that he started with Moses and Abraham and is going to continue it until now. And so some think it might be that David's talking about, hey, let's inherit this land fully as God has promised us. But I'm not so sure if that's the meaning behind the word inheritance or inherit the land. Some also think it could be a way of seeing this inheritance as a heaven. That David here is referring to the inheritance as heaven, our promised land that we're going to inherit one of these days. The sweet by and by, our promised land. See, all Christians have the promise of heaven, a land beyond our lives now. And David might have been talking about heaven. The Israelites at this time did have a small theory, a rudimental theology of heaven in the afterlife, but it was kind of basic. But I think it's something more than just a promise of a future land, of the future land in heaven. I think inheriting the land means God's blessing entirely, God's promises, God's benefits to all of Israel and all of Israel since then. Land could be used as a more figurative way and symbolic of God blessing you. God's promised land was more than just a place to live or a place to farm. It's more than just heaven. It's God providing for them in every way, blessing them. Let me read you some of these verses in context here that I have listed on the screen here. First time it's mentioned is in verse 9. It says, "For the evil men will be cut off, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land." A few verses later, verse 11, "The meek will inherit the land and enjoy peace." Down to verse 18, "The days of blessings are known to the Lord, and their inheritance will endure forever." Verse 22, "The Lord blesses, or those the Lord blesses will inherit the land. Those he curses will be cut off." Verse 27, "Turn from evil and do good, then you will dwell in the land forever." And then we have verses 29, but a little bit before that, verse 28, there it also says, "They will be protected forever, but the offspring of the wicked will be cut off. The righteous will inherit the land and dwell in it forever." So they have kind of the both of them there, dwell and inherit the land. And then verse 34 says, "Wait for the Lord and keep his ways. He will exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, you will see it." And so we see time and time again that this is not just blessings in the past or in the future, but blessings right now. You see, land here is seen as security. It's the same thing as if God had promised them the land, that the rest of the land, God's promises are going to be true. God's promised them, yes, you're going to inherit the land. And so therefore, since I kept that promise, my future promises can be relied upon. Reminds me of the song, I know God's promise is true, because we tested and tried and tested it. They have the security of knowing that God has been with them in the past, that they've helped them in the past, and so therefore God will help them in the future. We saw it last week as well. They also have the protection against any threats that God will meet. This is a theme throughout this chapter, that if they depend upon God, the wicked people will be cut off, that they will not succeed. Instead, the righteous will stand firm. So it's the idea of permanence about the land. You know, when you buy something, it's yours. When you have something, we just bought a new car here, and we bought it, and so we have the rights to that car. I mean, we don't have to as long as we make the payments on it, and as long as we put the gas in it, we can do whatever we want with that car. We can go down the highway and drive it, and we can decide to go up wherever we wanted to go. We can go. I mean, we don't have to go to the bank and say, hey, can we go up to Rockford to do something? Well, as long as you're making the payments, yes, you can go. You have that right. And so if you have that land, if you own something, you have blessings and right as landowners. And so we see that blessing as well in this idea of inheriting the land. Verse 3 also mentions safe pastures. You know, that the righteous will have safe pastures. And that kind of brings up the image that David has, of course, when we think of David preaching the psalm. This image of David and shepherding and leading and protecting and guiding and providing for all the needs. That's what a shepherd does. It provides safe pastures. Peace is mentioned in verse 11 as well. When you have the promise of the land, it kind of implies peace. That the land is yours. You don't need to fight for it. You see, conflict and fighting over land has been the basis for wars for millennia. And so you don't need to fight when you have the promise of land, when you have that as your inheritance. It's yours. You don't need to worry about it. You don't need to worry about fighting for it. Notice there in verse 11, I think it is. Yeah, verse 11. It says, the meek will inherit the earth. The meek, not the mightiest, will get to enjoy this land, enjoy this peace. This may have been what Jesus was hinting about in the Sermon on the Mount. Remember what he says in the Sermon on the Mount? Matthew 5:5. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. That's what Jesus says. Kind of pointing back here to Psalm chapter 37, verse 11. And so we have all these ideas of peace and security and ownership. We have all these protections and blessings and rights, these safeties, this confidence, all wrapped up in this idea of inheriting the land. All these are things, are blessings. And it's not just the land itself, but it's this idea of God is going to take care of you. God's going to watch out for you. God's going to look out for the righteous, even though it appears like the wicked are flourishing. I like what one of the commentaries said here. As you look at this inheritance in the psalm, it must be pointed out that these verses do not envision a complete escape for the righteous from the oppression or the suffering at the hands of the wicked. Rather, it offers those who take refuge in Yahweh, a place of security in the midst of suffering, and implies the spiritual balm to the anguished souls of the righteous as they affirm and reaffirm that Yahweh is the helper of the righteous. You see, having this peace and security in this land will not guarantee that we won't have suffering. It won't guarantee that we won't have troubles. It won't guarantee that the wicked will cause suffering for us. But we will have that place of peace in the midst of the suffering. Wilson goes on to say that this is the meaning and gives purpose to righteous suffering that transcends any hope for escape because they suffer for God. So what does the psalm teach us this morning? What's the general thing that we can learn from the psalm this morning? That God is looking out for the righteous. He rewards them who follow him. And this may even be during suffering. Maybe even when the wicked are flourishing and taking advantage of the righteous. But we should never let success of this around us, the success of the wicked around us, to undermine the goodness and justice of God. Again, Wilson says, this is not unrealistic wishful thinking, but a sincere commitment to understanding of the divine character that remains unshaken. You see, God is with us. So we don't need to worry. We don't need to fret or fear or to get burning up with anger. Because God has our back. God is backing us up. Our faith in God in this wicked world causes the worry and the fretting heart to cease. One commentary said, faith removes fretting. And I like how Wilson concludes his commentary on this chapter. He combines the first verse of Psalm 37 with the last verse and puts it this way. It says, "Do not fret because of evil men, because the salvation of the righteous comes from the Lord. He is their stronghold in a time of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them because they take refuge in him." Isn't that what it's all about? Isn't that what God's calling us this morning to say, hey, you don't need to fret or worry. You don't need to become angry when wicked people take advantage of you, because you have God, and we are to trust in him, to delight in him, and commit ourselves to his way. That's what it says there in Psalm verses 3 through 5. These are the commands that we're to go with this morning. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safety. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your ways to him, trust in him, and he will do this. That needs to be our focus this morning. That needs to be what we need to do for God to reward us. Because if our focus is on God, our worries, our angers, our frets, our fears about the world around us will fade, and we can have faith in God.